Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is West Side Editions on Blog Talk Radio. I am Brother Tony Bullock with my co-host, Sister Eileen Reed. Hello, Sister Reed.
Hey, Brother Bullock. How are you?
I am fine on this windy and blustery evening. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you.
All right. Tonight is our Black History Show, and I'm kind of pumped up about this one because we are going to talk about folks that normally don't get talked about. And, you know, in America, they had this real bad habit of always giving us what I call the usual suspects for Black history. So between you and I tonight, I think we're going to bring out some folks that many don't get to hear about.
I think you're right.
And with that being said, I'm going to say tonight's show, we actually have a sponsor. The sponsor is from That's Some Good Hot Sauce by a sister. We call her Sister Nikki on the internet. And she lives down in the Carolinas and has started, her and her husband, a barbecue sauce business and a hot sauce business. And I can tell you honestly, she has done an excellent job. I have to give them a shout-out and thank them for giving me a shout-out and sponsoring my little throw-together show. I really appreciate that.
Wow. That's wonderful. I hope she going to share some samples with us who are uninitiated.
Well, you know, my sister, you know, when I see you tomorrow, you will be getting your cut.
Thank you.
It is definitely called, gosh darn, that's some good hot sauce. And what I really like about it is everything in here is natural. It's grown in there. And
that's wonderful.
And it's a beautiful thing. And you know me, I always bet on Black.
That's the best way to go.
And again, for our local folks, and, you know, it plays right up in there with what our pastor talks about, Pastor Floyd Harris, being natural and going back to the ground. You know, the more I think about that, the more I have to give him credit for pushing that. You know, let's just be honest about it. We got to learn to take care of ourselves.
This is true.
Well, Sister Reed,
very true.
You know, you brought up that, it's very windy tonight, so we're going to hang in here with these folks the best we can. So I tell you what, we're going to get it started, and why don't you lead us off tonight?
Okay, well, you know, I wanted to we could have gone all the way back to the motherland, but I wanted to talk about something that was near and dear to my heart, and that is the Freedmen Schools that happened during the Civil War and right after the Civil War. So I wanted to talk a little bit about them. These schools were established by African Americans themselves. I want to make that clear. Literate Black men and Black women opened and self-sustained these schools. And so one of the earliest teachers in this was a woman called, this is a Black woman called Mary Peake, that's P-E-A-K-E, who was a Black teacher, and she taught what the government called contraband enslaved people. And she was based at Fortress Monroe in 1861. So this was before the end of the Civil War, and she was she's been hailed as one of the first black teachers from the North. Now, there were other women who came down and taught school, but Mary was one of the first ones. So check it out. She was teaching people who were legally still considered enslaved people. And she did this of their own accord. People have to understand that during chattel slavery, Africans were not allowed to learn to read and write. And this disenfranchising them of their education was a terrible thing, terrible. So these freedmen schools were very important. And then, I need to make a correction. Mary Peake was a teacher from the South. I may have said that, I may have left that out, but she was a teacher from the South, a black teacher from the South. Now, we also have a black teacher from the North, and her name was Charlotte Fortin. She taught for 2 years at a place called St. Helens. And, you know, you have to understand that there wasn't a lot of money floating around or anything like that. So a lot of these women and men were donating their time. But there was also a woman by the name of Susie King Taylor, and she taught freed slaves in Georgia. So these are names that I was not aware of, Mary Peake and Susie King Taylor. I had heard of Charlotte Fortin, but did not know a lot about her. But these are three women. There were men also who did teach formerly enslaved people how to read and write. So we have to understand that black people knew from the gate that it would be up to them to teach our own, to educate our own, and to nurture our own. So that's where I'm starting with tonight, Brother Tony.
Right. And, you know, I heard you use, and I remember when I was younger, I remember some of my great aunts and uncles using that very phrase, contraband children. Because right after the Civil War and the fact that our people had been free, this is what they considered us. They considered black folks, you know, we weren't really free. We were contraband. The invaders of the North was just barring us because eventually we were going to come back home to the South and go back to work.
Mm-hmm. This is true.
Yeah.
This is very true. But, you know,
And I heard you say there wasn't a lot of money going around, but this was during a time when I think a lot of these people took up teaching and passing that information on, knowing that they were risking their lives doing it. But
that's right.
It was important to them to keep education within our boundaries, to keep education
exactly
within our people.
That's right. That's right. And we have to understand that when you teach one person to read in our community, you're teaching not just that person, but you're teaching others. I mean, some of you may have seen photographs of young children who could read and write, teaching their mothers, their fathers, their grandmothers, their grandfathers. So when you teach one person in a family, you are not just teaching that one person. So we have to remember that.
Yes, they are. You are definitely and even nowadays, there are people out there who have younger kids going to school, and that older generation never really got that opportunity, never really got to go to school because they had to, you know, let's keep it real, they had to work fields, or they
right.
were what's the term I'm looking for? They were indentured workers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So instead of being in a classroom, they was in somebody's field or someone's house doing some
right.
kind of work. And
right. to sustain the family. That's right.
Exactly. And I think it's a beautiful thing when you get younger folks who go to school and then come home and teach their older generation something they have learned. That's a beautiful thing.
It really is. I know for a fact that my great niece has helped me with technology that I am not always up on, and she has helped me. So I can truly appreciate what you're saying about younger folks teaching older folks.
I will never forget. I was struggling with a program on my computer one time, and at the time, my youngest granddaughter was sitting there looking at me. She went, "Move, Papa." I was like, "What?" She said, "Watch this." So she sat there and tapped on the keys, beep, 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 beep. And I was like, and then she goes, "Did you see that?" I was like, "No, do it again." So she taught me these steps because I was having a problem with a program that should have been simple to me. But for her, being at that age, and not at there at that age where everything they learn in school on a computer. It was just no biggie for her.
No biggie at all. Yes, indeed. And, that is beautiful.
Yeah, but that is where we're headed now with our next generations. Everything is learned on a computer. I remember I asked her about her homework one time, and she told me, "I've already done my homework." And I was like, "Well, I haven't seen you sit at a table or anything." And she goes, "No, Papa, I did it on the computer." I was like, "What?" Because I didn't realize.
Yes.
It was no longer like what we used to do, sit down with a piece of paper and a pencil and try to figure it out. No, they get online, do it, and turn it in.
They get online, do it, and upload it, and there you have it. But it's a funny thing because they are starting in preschool on the computers, and it is just – it's fascinating. All the things that – my brain tries to struggle. I'm like, okay, let me remember all these steps so I can get where I need to be. It comes naturally to them, and I think that is a wonderful thing. I really do.
Oh, yeah. That is beautiful. Now, one of the people I wanted to talk about tonight was Sister Claudette Colvin. 9 months before Rosa Parks refused to give up her bus seat in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955, Sister Colvin refused to move to the back of the bus so that a white woman could take her seat, and she told the driver she had paid her fare and that it was her constitutional right to ride. And then he pulled the bus over and had her arrested. She says all she remembered was that she wasn't going to voluntarily walk to the back of the bus. Later on in the year, Sister Colvin became the main witness in a federal lawsuit of Brouser versus Gale, which brought an end to segregation on public transportation in the state of Alabama.
Wow, that's huge.
And that, that happened 9 months before Rosa Parks.
Wow.
Very rarely do you hear about that.
I was not familiar with her. Wow, that is some interesting information. And this sister's name should be known. There are a lot of heroes and sheroes during that time. Please continue, brother, if you have anything else. I've got a couple during that era myself, not like Rosa Parks, but in that same vein.
Oh, yeah. And then another gentleman, I've read about him before. When I was taking some classes at Fresno State in radio and TV communications, and that is Robert Singstack Abbott, and he really is the man who laid the foundation of what would be the birth of black publications like Ebony and Jet and Essence, Black Enterprise, and Sheen Magazine. In 1905. Mr. Abbott founded the Chicago Defender, which was a weekly newspaper that started out with a 25-cent investment as a four-page pamphlet, and the circulation increased every edition. And the beautiful thing about the Defender was it played an important role in getting blacks to migrate from the South to up north because of the better economic opportunities for them. That success of that particular paper made Mr. Abbott one of the first African-American self-made millionaires. And he also turned around and put money back into the black communities and helping other with the mind of Gil going into print, getting a start in the business.
Wow. Now that is huge. I've heard of the Chicago Defender, but I did not know its founder. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And see, I had heard, like you, I had heard of the Defender, but I didn't realize that the guy who founded it had played such an integral part in helping get black papers up and running. Not just his, but others in the area.
Right. Now, see, and that is so important, Brother Bullock, because, you know, back in those days when this brother was coming along, I mean, white newspapers never told the black side of the news. If we wanted to really hear something, yes, that was about us, that was truthful, it took newspapers like the Chicago Defender in order for us to get anything, Chicago Defender, Amsterdam News, newspapers like that, for us to get the real story about what was going on in the world. So, well, I had no idea that he had such an impact on the Great Migration as well. Now, that is something that I learned tonight.
Exactly. And see, that's the whole thing. White newspapers, if they mentioned us, we were either a criminal or it was someone like Frederick Douglass or someone like that that they felt like, well, we'll put a little blurb in there about them.
Right. Somebody that was an acceptable Negro. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. They've come, you know, they're different.
Wow. That is something. That is really something. Now, that's a good show.
Yeah, I look at that, and I think, you know, okay, he got into the paper business, but that part of what we talked about, the black migration to the north, and as you know, that meant a lot of brothers and sisters got out of houses, got out of fields, and moved up north and went to work in the plants, in the foundries, in the auto plants, in textiles. That not only changed the way we were being employed, but it helped uplift many from what was true poverty for them down south.
That's true. That's very very true.
I'm not gonna say it was perfect up north,
right?
But it was better than what they came from.
It was better. The wages were definitely better.
The wages were better.
So,
you know, they could work a job, go into a store and buy things and not be like it was down south where they went into Mr. Ed's store and bought something, even though they didn't pay full price. Well, they still had to pay Mr. Ed some extra because, well, you know, you paid for the item, but you ain't paid this tax on it. And
right.
Well, we're going to let you go with that and just build you up a line of credit.
Whether you wanted it or not. That's right.
So that they was always in debt to Mr. Ed.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And these are the kind of atrocities that black people were met with on a daily basis in the South. And they were looking for a better lifestyle, and they got it in the North. There was still racism, but at least it was some better.
Yes.
And that was so important.
You know, unfortunately, we still had to deal with that race issue because, as you know, right there in Chicago, we had some of the greatest race riots ever happen in the nation, right there in the city of Chicago.
Yes.
And that
one
was several times. Yeah.
Yes. No.
But again, it was better than dealing with what they dealt with down south.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, if it, let me know when you want me to go again, because I have.
Yeah, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, as we know, you know, when you were talking about Claudette and, you know, her involvement a few months before Rosa Parks, it really got me thinking about the movement, the civil rights movement, and I started thinking about a phrase that I heard about MLK and how much he really liked, you know, his Southern cooking and his meals and all that. So I did a little digging, and I came up with the name Georgia Gilmore. Now, Georgia was a Montgomery cook, and she was a midwife, as well as an activist. She ran a secret kitchen that fed the civil rights movement. And when the bus boycott in Montgomery, in Alabama, happened, Gilmore sold food to those who were gathered to organize. So these people were not on the buses. They were taking the cars and the trucks and the wagons and so forth to avoid being on the buses. Now, somebody had to pay for the gas. Somebody had to pay for repairs to those vehicles. And somebody had to pay for insurance. And Georgia Gilmore was one of the people who, from her cooking, was able to do that. And she and another group of women, she kind of called it the Club from Nowhere, sold pound cakes and sweet potato pies to help raise money for these things. And in fact, and something that I find just very poignant, this sister died on March 9th, 1990, and she died while preparing food for marchers that were commemorating the 25th anniversary of the March on Selma. So she was an activist for Black freedom and civil rights right up until the end. Georgia Gilmore was her name. It's amazing. And when you were talking about Chicago, it made me think of a sister by the name of Edna Stewart. She had a restaurant called Edna's Restaurant on Chicago's West Side, and she fed people like MLK, Jesse Jackson, and any number of local and national leaders for decades. In fact, her restaurant was considered a safe haven. Now there are other sisters who, you know, fed the movement, but I want to mention sisters like Leah Chase. She's pretty famous. She's down in New Orleans. She ran Dookie Chase Restaurant. Julia Freeman in Cleveland, Ohio. And one sister that I really need to mention is Irene Cleese, the owner of the Four Way Grill. And I'm mentioning her because many people think, historians think, that the last meal that MLK ate came from her restaurant. So this is Irene Cleese cooking, and Brother King had fried chicken, black-eyed peas, collard greens, and cornbread. And that was in Memphis. So it's hard, but we have to understand that people use what they had. These were Black cooks who just happened to be Black cooks who fed a movement. They fed a movement. Their restaurants, their home kitchens were considered safe places for a lot of activists. And we're talking whether they were local activists or national activists. These women fed them all. So that's spiritual and physical, sustenance for the body.
And the thing about it is, Black leaders at the time knew that was one of their meeting places in that city, because they knew they could go there, have a meal, and talk business without being bothered.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about, Brother Tony. And And that's why I said I've got to include these women and, you know, their contribution. I'm sure there are some men too, but this is our community. This is what we call community and family. And nobody does it alone. We hear about the big names, but we never hear about the small names. And while we're talking about this particular area, I want to throw out the name of Brother Pastor C.T. Vivian, who was one of MLK's lieutenants from SLCL, the Southern Leadership Conference. And C.T. Vivian really was a powerful pastor in his own right and a very, very strong leader. But we don't hear his name very often. So I just wanted to throw that out there, Brother Tony.
All right. You know, when I was younger, I had the pleasure of having a meal at Miss Leah Chase's restaurant. And
okay.
I can tell you honestly, it was down home, and it was the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was New Orleans. So, you know, look here. And then when she got older and her daughter took over, it was the same thing. You know, they held strong to them roots. And, you know, the thing about New Orleans is a lot of places there, many from Jesse Jackson, Dr. King, Al Sharpton, a lot of these cats have made the rounds down there in them back alleys and doorways and got some good food fed to them.
Mm-hmm. And that really, it makes all the difference. And I'm saying that, Brother Tony, because they were fed on many levels. And this is the same with the people who were very good about singing, coming up with lyrics and songs to keep people going while they were doing these these freedom riders. You know, we hear about Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin raised a lot of money for MLK during this time, and a lot of other, you know, people did too. They were famous, and it's wonderful they did what they did. And we know about Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer had a wonderful voice and really help to keep people's spirits up, you know, during this time. So I'm just saying that between the good food and the powerful spirituals and protest songs, you know, black people were able to keep going. Because think about it, we didn't have anybody else really supporting us but ourselves, you know, despite Hollywood and any white allies we might have had, it was up to us. It was because of our efforts that we were able to push that envelope for civil rights.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, you mentioned Aretha Franklin, who her and Sister Ethel Waters and Miss Lena Horne, they helped keep spirits up. And the FBI even had the audacity to bug Sister Aretha's Detroit home, her L.A. home.
Wow. They're relentless.
Yeah, they did those things. And, you know, it's just amazing. Sammy Davis Jr., he went through changes with them. It is amazing what our black folks have had to put up with. And, you know, a lot of people sit back and go, well, yeah, it couldn't have been that bad. Yeah, it was that bad.
It was that bad. It really was.
It is just astounding. And like you said, yes, during those times, during the civil rights days, yes, we had some white allies because the March on Washington and a few other places, there were some big name white folks in Hollywood that showed up and were part of the movement. But they weren't approached like black members, like Harry Belafonte. They didn't get hassled like, you know, the white folks didn't get hassled like that.
No, they didn't. And we have to understand when black entertainers did these things, they're putting their livelihood, their living on the line to do that.
Yeah.
And still they did it. had to have taken a lot of courage. You have to be pretty selfless to put your livelihood on the line for something that you believe in. And obviously they did it, and it made all the difference, in the world.
Not only did they do it, they stood fast. They didn't sell out. They didn't turn back.
Nope. And there were some, you know, working behind the scenes who, you know, I know for, well, I've read that Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, people like that, you know, they helped raise money. You know, the leaders like MLK and so on, they would call up and say, well, hey, you know, we need X amount of money, you know, here and here and here. And somehow these brothers, these Hollywood brothers, were able to get that money up, whether it was from their own pocket or calling around to people, and help to do that. That is a group effort. That is community. And we have to understand that a movement is not just a few people. A movement is many people all pushing together in the same direction.
That is so, so correct. And, you know, quiet as it's kept, Frank Sinatra was a big-time supporter because him and Sammy was close. And along with Frank came the Rat Pack. You know, you had Dean. You had Peter Lawford. These guys were involved.
Right. Because there were some famous, you know, white actors that were there in 1963. I remember seeing pictures of James Gardner and it was James Gardner. I want to say Charlton Heston, which is, you know, surprising.
Yeah, Charlton Heston was there
later on, but he was there. And he was, and he was on the right side of history at that time. So we have to acknowledge, you know, the allies that we had, but our people, Brother Tony, put so much on the line. I have a few more names during that era from SNCC, you know, but you let me know when I can throw them out, and I'll go ahead and do it.
No problem, but I'm going to piggyback on what you said about people working in the background, because Brother Bayard Rustin.
Yes.
Bayard Rustin was the driving force of the March on Washington, and that happened in August of 1963. Not only did he organize that historic event, which brought more than over 200,000 people together peacefully. I'm going to say that again, peacefully.
Peacefully.
You know, this is where Dr. King gave the famous I Have a Dream speech.
Right.
That one day, and we still waiting on that one day.
Yes.
But Brother Rustin was... He was also a gay black man, and he had some ties to communism. So he himself, you know, considered himself to be a liability to be out on the front line. So he worked in the background for the movement. You know,
yes,
he helped Dr. King form the Southern Leadership Conference.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And that is an important part, you know, of black history, that this gay black man, we're talking about during a time where gays were not accepted like they are today. And so he put himself at considerable risk, you know, doing all this. So that's important.
I mean, and he put himself at a big time risk.
Yeah, he did.
Not only was he a black man, he was a gay black man.
Exactly.
And like you said, it was at a time where they really, you know, gay people really caught it back then. They were beaten. They were killed. They were hung.
Yep. Yes,
to not only make the moves that he made, he was big time in civil rights. And from the East Coast to the West Coast, that man was known.
Yes.
he stayed, like you say, he stayed in the background, but he got a lot of things taken care of.
Yeah, he did. Yes, he did. And that's the most important message, Brother Tony, is that, you know, he got the job done. He wasn't looking for, you know, fame. He wasn't looking for, you know, all these accolades. He just, you know, did the work. And that was the most important thing to him, because think about this. That march on Washington in 63 was unprecedented. And there, I remember as a child that, you know, there was talk, oh, there's going to be a problem, there's going to be riots, people are going to get killed. And none of that happened. None of that happened. And Brother Rustin.
None of that happened.
Yes. You know, he organized and he must have had it sealed up tight where, you know, people didn't have to worry about the violence breaking out. If there was any violence, it wasn't coming from the people who were coming for the march. It would have been outside forces, but of course, you know, black folks would have got blamed for that. But I'm so glad you threw his name out there, because it's an important name that all of us should know.
You know, and the thing is, whenever you see film clips or you see pictures, you know, you look over that crowd and some people want to believe, oh, wow, all those black people. But it just wasn't black people. You had white folks. You had Orientals. You had East Indians. You had people worldwide who had come to Washington to attend that march.
Exactly. And why did they do that? Because they understood that that our cause was righteous. It was right. You know?
Exactly. Over 200,000 people.
Yes.
Right there.
Yes,
at the reflecting pool.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no violence. None.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the National Guard was out. The military was out. But there was no violence.
There was no violence. So, you know, and see, that's one of those myth-shattering occurrences about black people being violent, you know, inherently violent. We're pathologically violent, really.
Oh, yeah.
Really. So,
yeah. You're right about it. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was said about us, and it continues to be said about us.
It does. It really does. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we did a show last week about the 10-point plan of the Black Panther Party. And this is one of the reasons why the Black Panther Party was formed. If we're so violent, why is it that unarmed black people keep getting killed by the police? They were formed for self-defense purposes. Why? Because continue to get killed by the police. Unarmed black people. You know, and it's, this is something that's still going on today. It's 2023. And black men and women and other people of color, black and brown people, Asian people, people of color continue to get killed by the police. So We keep being victims. And we keep looking for a solution to this problem. And, you know, we need to try to come up with something pretty soon, folks, because these culture wars, as some people are calling it, between these right-wing, I call them right-wing fascist thinkers who happen to be in Congress, we're going to have a problem, because the younger generations that's coming up now are not going to take any crap, and they'll be ready to fight. So,
Yeah.
Like my aunt used to say, you got to bring ass to kick ass.
Exactly.
I'm not condoning violence, but, you know, I'm just being real.
But that's a true statement. They will let you know real quickly, you can catch these hands. No problem telling you that.
No problem.
But, you have to understand why. I was just reading a report the other day about someone in the Congressional House of Representatives talking about there needs to be a divorce between red and blue and southern and northern.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular person, whose name I shall not mention, but comes from the state of Georgia, just proves that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Instead of getting in there and...
They got their butts kicked in the Civil War trying to do this.
Say again?
Oh, I was just saying that, you know, the South tried to succeed before, and we know how that turned out.
Exactly. You know, but the thing about this is someone elected to an office where you ought to be working to build the nation up instead of tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what today's Republican Party is about. They're not about building this country.
No.
They're about making it separate but equal. And they prove it on a daily basis.
And we all know that separate and so-called separate but equal does not work. It just
does
not
work.
So, yeah, Republicans have a identity crisis going on. They still want to follow 45 and his racist, fascist belief system, but people are going to have to get involved. And, you know, it's often said that when America catches a cold, you know, black people get pneumonia, and we don't want that to happen. We want to nip this in the bud. So this is one of the reasons why we're doing this show, Brother Tony. And it is an important show to let people understand that you don't have to have a famous name in order to make a difference. You know, there are many people who we don't know their names, but they help to push a movement along and help make things better for all of us.
Yes, indeed, they did. And in case you are out there listening, our call-in number is 563-999-3043. Like to hear from you. If you want to call in and have something to say, please go right ahead.
Yes. Yes, because we're talking about an era, I guess it would be what, the late mid to late 50s through the 60s and early 70s of the Civil Rights Movement. I have some names that are associated with SNCC, and I'm going to throw them out if it's okay with you, Brother Tony.
Free, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, the first name, and I did some digging. There might be a couple of people in here that people are familiar with, but there was a young lady. Her name is Judy Robinson, and she was the field secretary for SNCC from 63 to 66. She was a student at Swarthmore College, a prestigious school, and she left Swarthmore after the first year to work with SNCC full-time. So she was one of the people who was instrumental in putting together freedom rides and things like that, and she worked with a sister by the name of Diane Nash. Now, Diane is a little bit more well-known than Judy, and Diane was a leader from the Nashville student movement. She voiced a need for the freedom rides to continue even after so many riders were met with initial violence and people wanted to call them off. Diane pushed to keep the riders on the buses and to keep them moving forward. Another name is Ruby Doris Robinson. This sister spent 30 days in jail, no bail, in Parchment Prison in Mississippi, and she came from the Atlanta student movement. We know that Fannie Lou Hamer, we know that she was part of SNCC, and two other names that come up are also Victoria Gray and Annie Devine. Hammer and Gray both worked for SNCC, and Divine Work for CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality. Laura McGee was a somebody who lived in Greenwood, Mississippi, and she and a sister named Mama Dolly Raines, McGee and Raines housed SNCC workers in their houses, and in fact, Dolly Raines sat outside of her house with a loaded shotgun to keep SNCC workers safe. Now, SNCC had a mentor that many of us will recognize, the name of Ella Baker, and she was a guy and a mentor to a lot of, but I had not heard of Dolly Raines, but she's my kind of sister. She's sitting out in front of her house with a loaded shotgun to keep these young people. Yes, sir.
And for those of you who are not familiar with SNCC, SNCC was the Student Nonviolent Coordinated Community.
That's right. That's right, Brother Tony.
They definitely helped get young black people into the movement. Not only civil rights, but also into the Black Panthers.
That's true. And one of the SNCC people who started off in SNCC and later broke off was Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture, who coined the phrase Black Power.
Yes, sir.
Started off in SNCC, yes.
Stokely, let everybody know. After a while, I'm not going to be singing, I'm going to be swinging.
There it is right there, underline. So these are names that, you know, are important. I had no idea, you know, when I started researching SNCC, I didn't know about Judy Robinson. I didn't know about Ruby Doris Robinson. I didn't know about Laura McGee, and I definitely did not know about Dolly Raines. Now, I knew a little bit about
Dolly is that sister.
Yeah.
Dolly was that sister.
Yes, she was. I mean, can you imagine? She's sitting out on her front porch keeping watch. That is commitment, because after these students left her house, she had to still live there.
That's commitment. She letting them know, you got to bring some and get some.
That's right. That is right. So, you know, we have been invested in our own freedom for a long time, and I hope listeners understand that being invested in your own freedom, you know, that means you don't owe anything to anybody. You know, you are taking care of your own business.
You are absolutely right with that, my sister. You know, but you speaking on that, you know what, I'm going to tell you about someone that became a hero for me when I was a shorty. As most black men, we have powerful women in our families, always have. And I remember somebody asking me about that one time. I said, well, one of the reasons why black women in our families are so powerful is because black men in our family were killed off. I can say this because I know for a fact I had several who were in our family line. And that's just a true statement. But this sister here, when I start at a young age paying attention to politics, became a hero of mine, and that's Sister Shirley Chisholm.
All right.
Now, I'm just going to tell you how it is. Shirley Chisholm kicked in the dough for black women holding major roles in the government. She first served as an educational consultant for the New York City Bureau of Child Welfare, and then she ran for the New York State Assembly in 1964. She was elected in 1968 as the first African-American congresswoman, and she served from 69 to 83, representing New York's 12th district. She was also a founding member of the Congressional Black College, and in 1972, was the first black woman to run for a major political party's presidential nomination under the Democratic Party. Her campaign slogan, unbought and unbossed.
Mm.
Hello. Now, what does that tell you?
She definitely unbossed kicked open that
and door. Unbossed.
She
was letting you know it was going to be her way and no one else's way. I look at that, and sisters like Kamala Harris.
Yes.
Maxine Waters.
Yes.
They all.
Auntie Maxine. Yes.
You know, they all have to pay Sister Shirley tribute.
That's right.
Because she helped pull that path.
Yes, she did. And, you know, that Sister Shirley Chisholm reminds me of another black sister during that same era, which is Barbara Jordan. And
yes,
I have
her.
Much respect for her because I remember coming home from middle school every day so I could watch her grill the people during the Watergate trials. And it's because of Barbara Jordan.
Oh, yes, she did.
That,
oh,
that
yes, she
I,
did.
You know,
Texas War, Texas Bread.
Interested. Yes, that I got interested in politics at all. I was like, you know, just she and Shirley Chisholm were two black women who didn't mind asking those hard questions. So I'm so glad you brought up Shirley Chisholm. Keep going, brother, because, wow.
Hey, Shirley Chisholm was that homegirl that you knew she was tough because she had to deal with them folks in New York City.
Yeah.
And I can remember when she first got to Washington, they thought they was going to run the okey-doke on her. They didn't. Not only was Shirley from New York, Shirley was a black woman.
Yes.
And you know, like I know, sisters will only put up with so much, and then they're getting ready to tell you about real.
Exactly. And don't make her take off her shoe to have to issue her to go. You know, if she got to go.
Look here,
she's
taking shoes and earrings off his own.
Hey. But no, she was a scrapper.
It's about getting furniture
moving. That's right. She was a scrapper, as was Barbara Jordan. But I remember reading articles about Shirley Chisholm and people saying, you know, how can she have the audacity, you know, to run for president? Well, why shouldn't she?
Exactly.
Why shouldn't she? So, yes, unbought and unbossed, I remember that very well. And I was like, this sister is too tough. She is too tough.
You know, for those who looked at my posting today, you will see two of her campaign pictures on there. And one of them is the unbought and unbossed poster.
Mm-hmm.
And it just tells you everything you needed to know about that woman.
Yeah.
She was not somebody who was going to let people make deals with her. You had to come to her correct.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's so important
I'm very, very proud of her. Because this was in a day when they, you know, we had, at that time, we had a few brothers in there, Adam Clayton Powell. And,
right.
You know, We had a few
mayors that became well known, like Carl Stokes, in Detroit, I believe. Yeah. So, but there wasn't a whole lot of us in Congress.
No, not at all. Not at all.
So that
and
so she
I will always. I will always. Give that sister my first salute because she did that there.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did.
And then there's another sister I'm going to talk about who, from the athletic side of the field, Sister Alice Coachman, who went to Tuskegee.
Right.
Sister Coachman became the first African-American woman from any country to win an Olympic gold medal in the 1948 Games in London.
Wow.
She set the record for the high jump at 5'6" 1/8". 4 years later, she became the first African-American woman athlete to endorse an international consumer product when she signed on as spokeswoman for Coca-Cola.
Whoa.
In the times that she competed, she won 43 national titles. She was inducted into the National Track and Field Hall of Fame in 1975 and the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame in 2004.
Hello. Wow.
Now,
and I
people might
knew
say,
something about Alex Boschman. I've learned something tonight.
Yeah. People might say, well, okay, well, she ran track and she did this and that, but what was big about that? Was big about that? Again, she was the first African-American woman from any country to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And for her to be a national spokeswoman for Coca-Cola in that time period, internationally, not just here in the U.S., internationally.
Wow. That's important stuff right there. That's important information right there.
Her face is being seen all over the world. And she one of us. She went to Tuskegee.
See. This history is so important, listeners. I really hope that you're hearing what we're saying tonight, because these are things that, you know, mainstream media is not going to talk about. They're not going to talk about our history. And even if they do, they're leaving out a lot of people. So we need to acknowledge and be grateful for this information about Sister Alice Coachman. I did not know about her endorsement, and I definitely did not know about the 43 national titles that she held during her life as a track star. I had no idea it was that many. So you putting it down tonight, Brother Tony.
Well, you know, my thing is this. You know, people watch sports. They watch football. They watch baseball, basketball. It's easy to get it caught up in the flash and dash. You know, I know a lot of people get excited about someone, you know, Michael Jordan. Okay, Mike was good. You know, and I understand that. But you have to look at the time period and go, this was a time when, and it's just like now, when they think the least of us.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems we have now in America. They're trying to get back to this thing of thinking the least of the contributions of Black America.
Say
and when people like these three speak on that, people go, well, why are you trying to bring it up? Why are you saying they treat us like that? Because they do.
Because they do.
They do. And some of
and
you, and I understand.
Yes. I
understand that some of you feel like you don't want to ruffle feathers. You don't want to make it rough on yourself. I'm at that stage of my life. I have nothing else to lose. What little life I got left, I'm going to use it doing the right thing. To me, this is doing the right thing, putting the information out there.
That's right.
Sister Reed, what else you got for us?
Actually, I did not have a lot more, but I did want to try to acknowledge all the brothers and sisters who were active in the Black Panther Party, those that we don't know that much about. And, you know, we had a conversation earlier today where we were talking about people like Brother George Jackson, his younger brother, folks like that. You know, we need to acknowledge the fact that these people believed in their Black community and, you know, suffered a lot for their Black community. And so I really didn't have a lot more to share, Brother Tony, because we could be – this could be a two-part show. But I'm so glad that we did what we did.
It probably is going to be a two-part show. I'm going to give you two more, and then we'll wrap it up for tonight. And I'll tell you what, Thursday we'll pick back up.
All right.
So, piggyback on what you just said, I'm going to give you Brother George Jackson. author, activist, and prisoner. He was serving an indeterminate sentence for the robbery of a gas station in 1961. And indeterminate means he was serving anywhere from 1 year to life and beyond.
Wow.
For robbing a gas station of $70. Now, when he was sent to prison, this is where he became involved in revolutionary activities after reading different works of Mao and Guerrero, people that of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened the Black Guerrilla family in prison, which had ties to the Black Panther Party.
That's correct.
Now, in 1970, he was charged with two other Soledad brothers, and I will talk about this, the Soledad connection. I'll talk about that later, with the murder of a correctional officer named John Vincent Mills, who, in a prison riot, had killed three Black men who had ties to the Black Panther Party and the Black Guerrilla family. Now, there was a prison riot, and during this prison riot, these three men just happened to get shot and killed by this particular guard, who ended up getting killed in the aftermath of a prison fight. Now, Brother Jackson and two others were charged with his murder, but it was always hinky on how those charges came about.
Right.
Then, during another prison riot in 1971, Brother Jackson was killed by prison guards. And to this day, that death remains controversial.
Wow.
And many people believe that his death, you know, they want to say that he was trying to, you know, he had brought his lawyer in and he was trying to escape prison and use his lawyer as a shield. But a lot of people believe that man was just flat out assassinated by those prison guards.
Right.
On orders from the warden and, of course, the FBI.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
wow.
I, for one, am willing to go with that. But I'll tell you what we're going to close out with, Sister Reed. Dr. Patricia Bath, who was an ophthalmologist and a laser scientist, and was not only the first African-American doctor to patent a medical device, but she was also the person to invent surgery that advanced the treatment for cataracts.
Whoa.
Now, people don't know that.
I did not know that.
Cataract surgery, you got Dr. Bash to thank for that. Dr. Bash.
We are an awesome people.
Girl.
I'm sorry, baby. Continue.
No, no, go right ahead.
No, I was just saying out loud, mumbling to myself, that we're an awesome people.
Yes, we are. That needs to be applauded. This woman came up with the surgery for cataracts. Well, once upon a time, the way they dealt with cataracts was gave somebody some super dark shades.
Exactly. And that was that. Wow.
Dr. Bath invented the laser Farco probe in 1981, which used lasers to treat cataracts precisely and less painfully. The invention helped recover vision for people who had been blind or visually impaired for decades.
Whoa.
In 1970-73, she was the first African-American resident in ophthalmology at NYU School of Medicine.
Mm.
In 1974, she was the first African-American woman surgeon at the UCLA Medical Center. And she was an assistant professor at only HBCU on the West Coast, Charles R. Drew University.
Mm-hmm. I'll be darned.
That's a Black woman.
Yes. Come on.
See.
See.
when they tell you that, hey, they don't do nothing but be thugs. Well, okay, you see what thugs do.
See. Oh man. I'm sitting here shaking my head, Brother Tony, like, you know what? That is just, it's just awesome. I mean, think about where we started off in this country to where we are now and the accomplishments of this sister that, you know, 5 minutes ago, I didn't know who she was, and now I do, and I'm so proud. It's just... listeners, you have to excuse me if I gush, but I love my people. I really do. And,
man, I love
you know,
my people.
The journey that we've been on, yes, Brother Tony, is just, it's mind-boggling. It really is.
It really is. And the thing about it is, you know, if you choose to believe what they say about us, you would be like, oh, we don't do too much. But the bottom line and the truth is America would be nothing without black folks. We built this country. And I'm not saying that no one else had a hand in it, because I know for a fact they used the Chinese to build railroads.
Yes, they did.
But for the most part, this country was built by black folks. We built the South. We built the North. We built the capitals.
Yep, we did. We sure
dad.
Built. We did a lot of wrought iron work in New Orleans. I know that for a fact.
Yes, we did. We did so, that, and we built. We look here. People can keep quiet as they want to, but we built a whole bunch of skyscrapers in New York. Just wasn't white folks. The reason why I know this, my dad worked on some.
See, I hear
he
you,
walked,
Brother Tony.
He walked them beans.
My dad was a construction worker too, and you know, little people don't talk about the black construction workers that worked on, you know, the dam right here in the Central Valley on Milton.
Oh
Lake.
Yeah,
they don't talk about that.
Frying Dam. Yeah, Frying Dam. Oh yeah,
exactly.
We have worked on the highways and byways of this country. Well, we are definitely going to do the second part of this show this Thursday, and we're going to hit you with some more things. Sister Reed, I, like I said, like I tell you all the time, I appreciate you taking this ride with me. And I do believe
it.
I kind of got a few over on you tonight.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did, but you do quite a lot, but... yeah, you definitely did, and I appreciate the knowledge, brother.
Hey, so we gonna call it a night, and we're going to get at it next week. Sister Reed, tell them what you always tell them.
Y'all know what I'm going to say. I want you to stay black till we get back.
And as I always tell y'all at my party, each one reach one, teach one. Those of you who are proficient with your firearms, take your people to the range. Get them trained up. Start a neighborhood watch. Start a cop watch. Watch the people who are watching us. Take care of your family. Take care of them folks in your neighborhood. You elders, please talk to our younger black folks. Put some education in their mind. Because in unity, there is survival. And we truly need to survive. Everybody stay tight and stay together. We're going to holler at you.